Hello, this is Paul Saunders, President of the Center for the National Interest. Thank you for joining us again this week for three questions. Today, I'm really pleased to have with me Doug Hengel. Doug is a former career diplomat. Doug, you're still very much working, just not at the Department of State. So Doug is a former American diplomat with very broad experience on energy issues, including serving as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Sanctions and Commodities toward the tail end of the George W. Bush administration and the early period of the Obama administration, 2007 to 2010. And in that role, Doug played an important part in formulating America's international energy policy and also represented the United States on the governing board of the International Energy Agency in Paris, which hopefully involved frequent trips to Paris. Currently, Doug is a senior consultant with an organization called LNG Allies, which, as one could guess from the name, focuses on liquefied natural gas and America's exports. He's also an adjunct lecturer at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a visiting senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. So, Doug, thank you very much for being with me today on three questions. We're going to talk about American energy exports and specifically LNG, which has been in the news a little bit lately. So, my first question for you, President Trump, of course, recently has announced this huge trade deal with the European Union. And as a part of that, the EU has pledged to buy $750 billion in American energy over a 3-year period. And what I'd like to ask is, what could that mean for the American energy industry? And do you think it's a realistic goal?
Thank you, Paul. I'm very pleased to be here with you today. And you are right. I'm not really retired. My wife sometimes complains about that, but I'm involved in a number of activities related to energy. So regarding your question on the US-EU deal, so there's been a lot of analysis done on the numbers. Do they add up? Is it possible that the United States could supply Europe with $250 billion in energy each year for the next 3 years, given current US energy exports? And since other countries are committing to buy more US energy as well, like Japan and South Korea. So I don't think that US energy exports are going to flow to Europe each year for the next 3 years at a rate of $250 billion a year. But I don't think that's the way to look at this. We shouldn't focus just on the narrow commodity flow mathematics. I think this deal represents a framework for a comprehensive transatlantic energy security alliance, both purchases and investments, that has the potential to shape the American and European industrial landscapes for a long time, for decades, to complement NATO and our military alliance. I think it's really a win-win for both sides. So it's not only about cargoes of liquefied natural gas or of oil and petroleum products. It's about technology transfer. It's about nuclear cooperation. It's about hydrogen and geothermal technologies, gas turbines, industrial modernization, even artificial intelligence. We should look at the entire energy ecosystem to evaluate the value of this relationship. So the White House has talked about this deal marking a generational modernization of the transatlantic alliance. The European Commission has said similar things. They've said that this political agreement between the EU and the United States will further increase cooperation on ensuring secure energy supplies. We need to remember that the European Union also has a plan to eliminate the remaining Russian gas and oil in their system by the end of 2027. They're still buying a significant amount of of Russian natural gas now, something like 25 million tons per year. So there's an American LNG producers, I think, are uniquely positioned to fill that gap. We also need to think about this in terms of deals that would be done. So, for example, Eni, the Italian company, recently signed a deal with Venture Global for 2 million metric tons per annum of LNG for 20 years. The value of that deal alone will be over $20 billion. That's pretty significant. There was at least one other LNG deal signed with a European company earlier this year, and there are ongoing negotiations for several other deals. European companies are also looking at taking equity stakes, so investment in U.S. facilities. There are also deals pending for nuclear plants or small modular reactors, other energy technologies. So there's a huge potential here for U.S. European trade, which this deal sets the stage for. So we should think about it as a framework. The U.S. energy industry is doing pretty well in any case. So the U.S. LNG industry is growing quite strongly. We will at least double our export capacity by 2030 with the projects that are already under construction. There have been three final investment decisions this year for new or expanded LNG projects, and several more are pending. So I think it's pretty clear that 2025 will mark the biggest year for U.S. LNG in terms of final investment decisions and new export capacity getting underway. So that has lots of positive impacts on the U.S. economy as well.
That's great. No, thanks very much, Doug. You know, for those of us who have been around for a little while, it's kind of remarkable to think about the United States as a major energy exporter, you know, something that wasn't really the case for a long period of time. So, you know, outside of Europe, some of our other really big customers are in Asia, you know, certainly where LNG is concerned, to include, you know, Japan, Korea, also Taiwan. And the administration, the Trump administration, has been encouraging those three governments to participate in a big Alaska LNG pipeline and project. That's estimated to be a $44 billion project. Do you think that's likely to go forward, the Alaska LNG? And does the EU deal or the recent agreements with Japan or Korea, do they have any bearing on that?
Yes. Well, so prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Asia was by far the largest market for U.S. LNG exports. And that will be, I think, the case again in the future, because that's the growth market, particularly South and Southeast Asia. South Korea remains the largest single market for U.S. LNG to date. And it's also possible that demand in Japan and South Korea will increase as well. They are also, looking at data centers and the like. So multiple deals have been signed by U.S. companies to ship LNG to Asia. This year, there have been three sales and purchase agreements alone so far this year with JERA, deal with Petronas, and there are several negotiations ongoing. And as I noted earlier, there's a major expansion of U.S. energy exports to Japan and South Korea foreseen under the trade deals that the U.S. has signed with them. And that could include investments in LNG in the United States, including with Alaska. So specifically regarding the Alaska LNG project, it's been around for a long time, and it's easy to be skeptical about it for that reason and given the cost. But I think a few things have changed. One is that this is a real priority for President Trump. He has seen China become more active in the Arctic, so we need to become more active as well. And this is one way to do that with energy. There is a serious, experienced energy project developer behind the project now, Glenn Farne. The pipeline involved is roughly a third of the project cost, and that's going to have to be built for Alaska, at least as far down to Anchorage from the North Slope, regardless of whether there's an LNG project or not, because Alaska needs the gas. So if you break off the pipeline or most of the pipeline from the rest of the project, the costs come down significantly. The economics may also be more attractive. This is stranded gas currently on the North Slope of Alaska. It will be sold at a fixed price, not at a fluctuating Henry Hub price, so that which may have some volatility associated with it, so that may be attractive. Also, the shipping costs are significantly lower to go from Alaska to Japan, South Korea, elsewhere in Asia than it is from the Gulf Coast of the United States. Countries may be interested in that, the security aspects of this compared to some other LNG sources. You don't have any choke points you have to go through to get at least to Northeast Asia. You don't, this gas would not be shipped through Straits of Hormuz or the South China Sea. The Department of Energy has significant loan guarantees behind the project. So I think the picture has changed. Will it be enough? There is interest being expressed from at least Thailand and Taiwan and India in the project. So,
well, time will tell. Very good pitch there. However, thank you very much, Doug. So my third and final question for you, and here I'll note, you know, that we're recording this a few days in advance of when it will appear online. But, you know, the other big energy topic in the news for many Americans right now is the fact that, you know, President Trump has threatened what amount to secondary sanctions in the form of tariffs on Russia's energy customers if Russia doesn't come to some kind of arrangement to cease fire in Ukraine. And the president has established this deadline of August 8th for that, which is still a few days away. You know, Russia's biggest oil customers are China and India. Do you think that China or India would be likely to put any pressure on Russia to try to reach a deal in order to avoid tariffs, you know, American tariffs because of their continued purchases of Russian oil? Do you think that this will put, you know, more pressure on Putin? Will Trump follow through? What do you expect?
A lot of important questions there. Well,
yeah, that's a big third question.
So if you want to pressure Russia, there's two key ways: supplying arms to Ukraine, more arms to Ukraine, and negatively affecting their revenues. And that means oil, which supplies so much of their budget. So, I mean, as many have noted, oil is the lifeblood of Putin's war machine. So India buys, you know, the last numbers I saw were 38% of Russia's crude oil exports, and China buys 47% of Russia's oil exports. So they're the big guys. And as you noted, President Trump has threatened secondary sanctions on both of them for their energy purchases. I guess one thing that struck me is that the president and the administration have been a little tougher in their threats on India than on China. We'll see if that holds. And in general, the U.S. relationship with India seems to have been under some strains recently over trade and other issues. So sanctions are, as you know, are meant to change behavior. In this case, Russia's behavior, but also India and China. And hopefully this will lead to pressure from both of them on Russia regarding its actions in Ukraine, although I have some doubts that will be the case. You know, China's initial reaction is on this threat has been as it normally, its response has been as it normally does. It's been kind of defiant. They'll say they'll, you know, take the steps that are needed for their own country's energy security, their national interests, and safeguard their sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. India has been sending some mixed messages. So, I mean, we'll see what they do in terms of their impact. So the oil market is quite big. It's quite flexible. It adjusts. It adapts to shifts in supply. We've seen there are a lot of workarounds to sanctions. China has a lot of experience in this regard, as does Russia. Shadow fleets, repackaging the oil, blending it, you know, all of these things are used by different countries. India has less experience with that, I would say. So even though the market can adapt and adjust, we'd be talking about a pretty massive adjustment. If China and India were to limit or stop their oil purchases from Russia, this would be something that could not happen quickly. And I don't think it would happen without at least some volatility in oil prices, maybe a jump in oil prices. Who would buy the Russian oil if these countries stopped doing so? I don't think there's other big markets that could certainly absorb those kind of quantities. So, you know, if you had 1 to 3 million barrels a day of oil off the market, that's a pretty big shock, I would think. You know, what will OPEC Plus do? Will they put more oil on the market? What will happen to demand? You could say that, you know, this all these tariffs that are being implemented will impact demand. So there's a lot of different scenarios you could look at going, you know, forward this year. More supply will be coming on the market from the United States and others. So I think this could lead to more volatility. That would be the minimum. And what will Russia's reaction be if these countries were to decide to limit their imports? I mean, one thing Russia could easily do is to retaliate by stopping or limiting exports from the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, the pipeline that runs from Kazakhstan, where Chevron and Exxon are big interests, big stakes in it. So that pipeline is carrying, you know, something of around 1.7 million barrels a day now. So that could be another, you know, hit to the market. I think there would be likely a lot of pushback if oil prices jumped. President Trump has been quite focused on gasoline prices in the United States. So that could impact his willingness to enforce sanctions if they were to be implemented. So I think one other thing I wanted to say about this is that president's interest in this issue, I think, bodes well for U.S. LNG because there's been some concerns about what would happen to Russian sanctions on Russia regarding the Arctic LNG 2 project, which were implemented during the Biden administration. You know, would the Trump administration continue to enforce them? There have been reports recently that Novatek, which is the company behind the Arctic LNG 2 project, has been starting it up again, has been shipping some tankers out full of LNG. Will they find a home? So that's another issue that's tied up in this.
You know, some might take the view that, you know, when we're imposing all of these sanctions to try to slow down that project, one of the best things we can do with the extra time actually is to increase our own exports and try to prevent that market from even existing in the future. A lot to think about there too. So thank you very much, Doug Hengel, for joining me today on Three Questions. As a reminder to the audience, you know, Doug, a former career diplomat, deputy assistant secretary of state, a lecturer here in Washington at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, working also with the German Marshall Fund as a visiting fellow and with LNG Allies. So Doug, thank you for joining me today. Great
conversation.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.